In the world? She adds. Yes, Bailey says. He cannot keep himself from smiling, despite her serious tone and the nerves that are still keeping his heart from beating at a steady rate. Then you are a rêveur, Elizabeth pronounces, no matter what you wear. They tell him stories of the circus and of other rêveurs, how there is a society of sorts that keeps track of the movement of the circus, notifying other rêveurs so they might travel from destination to destination. Victor and Lorena have followed the circus as often as their schedules allow for years, while Elizabeth typically only makes excursions closer to New York, and this trip is an extended one for her. Though there is an informal club of rêveurs based in the city that holds gatherings from time to time to keep in touch while the circus is away. The train arrives shortly after the sun has fully risen, and on the way to Boston, the stories continue while Elizabeth knits and Lorena props her head up sleepily on her arm.
Where are you staying in town?
Elizabeth inquires. Bailey has not considered this, as he has been taking this endeavor one step at a time, attempting not to worry about what might happen once they reach Boston.
I'm not entirely sure, he says. I'll probably stay at the station until I know where to go next. Nonsense, Victor says. You shall stay with us. We have nearly an entire floor at the Parker House. You can have August's room. He went back to New York yesterday, and I never bothered to alert the management that we have an unoccupied room.
Bailey attempts to argue, but Lorena stops him.
He is terribly stubborn, she whispers. He will not take no for an answer once he has set his mind to something.
And indeed, Bailey is swept into their carriage almost as soon as they step off the train. His bag is taken along with Elizabeth's luggage when they reach the hotel.
Is something wrong?
Lorena asks as he openly stares around the opulent lobby.
I feel like one of those girls in fairy tales. The ones who don't even have shoes and then somehow get to attend a ball at the castle,
Bailey whispers, and she laughs so loudly that several people turn and stare. Bailey is escorted to a room half the size of his entire house, but he finds he cannot sleep, despite the heavy curtains blocking out the sunlight. He paces the room until he begins worrying about damaging the carpet, and then he sits in the window instead, watching the people below. He is relieved when there is a knock at the door, mid-afternoon.
Do you know where the circus is yet?
He asks before Victor can even speak.
Not yet, dear boy, he says. We sometimes have advance notice of where it is headed, but not as of late. I imagine we will have word by the end of the day, and if our luck holds, we will depart first thing in the morning. Do you have a suit?
Not with me, Bailey says, remembering the suit packed in a trunk at home that was only ever pulled out for special occasions. He guesses he has likely outgrown it in the interim, unable to recall exactly what the last suit-worthy occasion was.
We shall get you one then,
Victor says, as though this is as simple a thing as picking up a newspaper. They meet Lorena in the lobby, and the two of them drag him around town on a number of errands, including a stop at a tailor for his suit.
No, no, Lorena says while they look at samples. These are entirely wrong for his colouring. He needs a grey, a nice deep grey.
After a great deal of pinning and measuring, Bailey ends up with the nicest suit than he has ever owned in his life, nicer even than his father's best suit in a charcoal grey. Despite his protestations, Victor also buys him very shiny shoes and a new hat. The reflection in the mirror looks so different from the one he is accustomed to that Bailey has difficulty believing it is really him. They return to the Parker House with a multitude of packages in tow, stopping by their rooms for hardly enough time to sit before Elizabeth comes to take them down to dinner. To Bailey's surprise, there are almost a dozen rêveurs waiting in the restaurant downstairs, some who will be following the circus and others who are remaining in Boston. His anxiety at the fanciness of the restaurant is eased by the casual, boisterous manner of the group. True to form, they are clad almost entirely in black and white and grey, with bright touches of red on ties or handkerchiefs. When Lorena realizes that Bailey has no red, she surreptitiously removes a rose from a nearby floral arrangement to tuck in his lapel. There are endless stories from the circus related over each course, mentions of tents Bailey has never seen, and countries he has never even heard of. Bailey mostly listens, still rather astounded that he has stumbled upon a group of people who love the circus as much as he does. Do you think anything is wrong with the circus? Bailey asks quietly, when the table has fallen into separate conversations. Recently, I mean. Victor and Lorena glance at each other, as though gauging who should respond, but it is Elizabeth who answers first.
It has not been the same since Herr Thiessen died, she says.
Victor frowns suddenly, while Lorena nods in agreement.
Who is Herr Thiessen? Bailey asks.
The three of them look somewhat surprised by his ignorance.
Frederick Thiessen was the first of the Revers, Elizabeth says. He was the clockmaker. He made the clock inside the gates.
That clock was made by someone outside the circus?
Really?
Bailey asks. It is not something he had ever thought to ask Poppet and Widget about. He had assumed it was a thing born of the circus itself. Elizabeth nods.
He was a writer as well, Victor says. That is how we met him years and years ago. Read an article he wrote about the circus and sent him a letter, and he wrote back, and so on. That was before we were even called Revers. He made me a clock that looks like the carousel,
Lorena says, looking wistful,
with little creatures that loop through clouds and silver gears. It is a wonderful thing. I wish I could carry it around with me. Though it is nice to have a reminder of the circus I can keep at home. I heard he had a secret romance with the illusionist,
Elizabeth remarks, smiling over her glass of wine.
Gossip and nonsense,
Victor scoffs.
He did always sound very fond of her in his writing,
Lorena says, as though she is considering the possibility.
How could anyone not be fond of her?
Victor asks. Lorena turns to look at him curiously.
She is extremely talented,
he mumbles, and Bailey catches Elizabeth trying not to laugh.
And the circus isn't the same without this Herr Thiessen?
Bailey asks, wondering if this has something to do with what Poppet had told him.
It is different without him for us, of course,
Lorena says. She pauses thoughtfully before she continues,
The circus itself seems a bit different as well. Nothing in particular, only something. Something off kilter,
Victor interjects,
like a clock that is not oscillating properly.
When did he die?
Bailey asks. He cannot bring himself to ask how.
A year ago tonight, as a matter of fact,
Victor says.
Oh, I had not realized that,
Lorena says.
A toast to Herr Thiessen,
Victor proposes loud enough for the entire table to hear, and he raises his glass. Glasses are lifted all around the table, and Bailey raises his as well. The stories of Herr Thiessen continue through dessert, interrupted only by a discussion about why the cake is called a pie when it is clearly cake. Victor excuses himself after finishing his coffee, refusing to weigh in on the cake issue. When he returns to the table, he has a telegram in his hand.
We are headed to New York, my friends.
Impasse. Montreal, August 1902. After the illusionist takes her bow and disappears before her rapt audience's eyes, they clap, applauding the empty air. They rise from their seats, and some of them chatter with their companions, marveling over this trick or that as they file out the door that has reappeared in the side of the striped tent. One man sitting in the inner circle of chairs remains in his seat as they leave. His eyes, almost hidden in the shadow cast by the brim of his bowler hat, are fixed on the space in the center of the circle that the illusionist occupied only moments before. The rest of the audience departs. The man continues to sit. After a few minutes, the door fades into the wall of the tent, invisible once more. The man's gaze does not waver. He does not so much as glance at the vanishing door. A moment later, Celia is sitting in a chair across the circle from him, still dressed as she had been during her performance, in a black gown covered with delicate white lace. "You usually sit in the back," she says.
"I wanted a better view," Marco says.
"You came quite a ways to be here."
"I had to take a holiday."
Celia looks down at her hands.
"You didn't expect me to come all this way, did you?"
Marco asks.
"No, I did not."
"It's difficult to hide when you travel with an entire circus, you know."
"I have not been hiding," Celia says.
"You have," Marco says. "I tried to speak with you at Herr Thiessen's funeral, but you left before I could find you. And then you took the circus across the ocean. You've been avoiding me."
"It was not entirely intentional," Celia says.
"I needed some time to think.
Thank you for the pool of tears," she adds.
"I wanted you to have a place where you felt safe enough to cry if I could not be with you."
She closes her eyes and does not reply.
"You stole my book," Marco says after a moment.
"I'm sorry," she says.
"As long as it is somewhere safe, it does not matter whether I keep it or you do. You could have asked. You could have said goodbye."
Celia nods.
"I know," she says.
Neither of them speaks for some time.
"I am trying to make the circus independent," Celia says, "to untie it from the challenge, from us, from me. I needed to learn your system to make it work properly. I cannot let a place that is so important to so many people fade away, something that is wonder and comfort and mystery altogether, that they have nowhere else. If you had that, wouldn't you want to keep it?"
"I have that whenever I'm with you," Marco says.
"Let me help you."
"I don't need your help.
You cannot do this alone."
"I have Ethan Barris and Lainey Burgess," Celia says.
"They have agreed to assume management for the basic operation. With a little more training, Poppet and Widget should be able to handle the manipulation aspects that Ethan and Lainey cannot manage. I do not need you."
She cannot look him in the eye.
"You don't trust me," he says. "Isabel trusted you," Celia says, looking at the ground. "So did Chandresh. How can I believe that you are honest with me and not with them when I am the one you have the most reason to deceive?"
"I never once told Isabel that I loved her," Marco says. "I was young and I was desperately lonely and I should not have let her think I felt more strongly than I did. But what I felt for her is nothing compared to what I feel for you. This is not a tactic to deceive you. Do you think me that cruel?"
Celia rises from her chair.
"Good night, Mr. Alistair," she says.
"Celia, wait,"
Marco says, standing, but not moving closer to her.
"You are breaking my heart. You told me once that I reminded you of your father, that you never wanted to suffer the way your mother did for him, but you are doing exactly that to me. You keep leaving me. You leave me longing for you again and again when I would give anything for you to stay, and it is killing me."
"It has to kill one of us," Celia says quietly.
"What?"
Marco asks.
"The one who survives is the victor," she says.
"The winner lives, the loser dies.
That's how the game ends."
"That..." Marco stops, shaking his head.
"That cannot be the intent of this."
"It is," Celia says.
"It is a test of endurance, not skill. I'm attempting to make the circus self-sufficient before..."
She cannot say the words, still barely able to look at him.
"You're going to do what your father did?"
Marco says.
"You're going to take yourself off the board?"
"Not precisely," she says. "I suppose I was always more my mother's daughter."
"No," Marco says. "You cannot mean that."
"It's the only way to stop the game."
"Then we'll continue playing."
"I can't," she says. "I can't keep holding on. Every night it becomes more difficult, and I have to let you win."
"I don't want to win," Marco says. "I want you. Truly, Celia, do you not understand that?"
Celia says nothing, but tears begin to roll down her cheeks. She does not wipe them away.
"How can you think that I don't love you?" Marco asks.
"Celia,
You are everything to me. I don't know who is trying to convince you otherwise, but you must believe me, please.
She only looks at him with tear-soaked eyes, the first time she has held his gaze steadily.
This is when I knew I loved you, he says.
They stand on opposite sides of a small round room, painted a rich blue and dotted with stars, on a ledge around a pool of jewel-toned cushions. A shimmering chandelier hangs above them.
I was enchanted from the moment I first saw you, Marco says, but this is when I knew.
The room around them changes again, expanding into an empty ballroom. Moonlight filters in through the windows.
This is when I knew, Celia says,
her voice a whisper echoing softly through the room. Marco moves to close the distance between them, kissing away her tears before catching her lips with his own. As he kisses her, the bonfire glows brighter. The acrobats catch the light perfectly as they spin. The entire circus sparkles, dazzling every patron. And then the immaculate cohesion stops as Celia reluctantly breaks away.
I'm sorry, she says.
Please, Marco says, refusing to let her go, his fingers holding tightly to the lace of her gown.
Please, don't leave me.
It's too late, she says. It was too late by the time I arrived in London to turn your notebook into a dove. There were too many people already involved. Anything either of us does has an effect on everyone here, on every patron who walks through those gates. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people. All flies in a spider web that was spun when I was 6 years old, and now I can barely move for fear of losing someone else.
She looks up at him, lifting her hand to stroke his cheek.
Will you do something for me? She asks. Anything, Marco says.
Don't come back, she says, her voice breaking.
She vanishes before Marco can protest, as simply and elegantly as at the end of her act, her gown fading beneath his hands. Only her perfume lingers in the space she occupied moments before. Marco stands alone in an empty tent, with nothing but two rings of chairs and an open door, waiting for him to leave. Before he departs, he takes a single playing card from his pocket and places it on her chair. Visitations. September 1902. Celia Bowen sits at a desk surrounded by piles of books. She ran out of space for her library some time ago, but instead of making the room larger, she has opted to let the books become the room. Piles of them function as tables. Others hang suspended from the ceiling, along with large golden cages holding several live white doves. Another round cage, sitting on a table rather than hanging from above, contains an elaborate clock. It marks both time and astrological movements as it ticks steadily through the afternoon. A large black raven sleeps uncaged alongside the complete works of Shakespeare. Mismatched candles in silver candelabras, burning in sets of three, surround the desk in the center of the room. Upon the desk itself, there is a slowly cooling cup of tea. A scarf that has been partially unraveled into a ball of crimson yarn, a framed photograph of a deceased clockmaker, a solitary playing card long separated from its deck, and an open book filled with signs and symbols and signatures procured from other pieces of paper. Celia sits with a notebook and pen, attempting to decipher the system the book is written in. She tries to think the way she imagines Marco might have as he wrote it, picturing him inscribing each page, rendering the delicate ink branches of the tree that winds throughout the book. She reads each signature over and over, checking how securely each lock of hair is pasted, scrutinizing each symbol. She has spent so much time repeating this process that she could recreate the book from memory, but she still does not fully comprehend how the system works. The raven stirs and caws at something in the shadows.
You're bothering Hugin, Celia says without looking up.
The candlelight catches only the edges of her father's form as he hovers nearby, highlighting the creases of his jacket, the collar of his shirt, glinting in the hollows of his dark eyes.
"You should really get another one," he says, peering at the agitated raven. "A Munin to complete the set."
"I prefer thought to memory, Papa," Celia says. is the only response. Celia ignores him as he leans over her shoulder, watching her flip through the inscribed pages.
"This is a god-awful mess," he says.
"A language you cannot speak yourself is not necessarily a god-awful mess," Celia says, transcribing a line of symbols into her notebook.
"This is messy work, bindings and charms," Hector says, floating to the other side of the desk to get a better look. "Very much Alexander's style. Overly complicated and covert.
Yet, with enough study, anyone could do it. Quite the contrast to all your lectures about how I was special."
"You are special. You are beyond this."
He waves a transparent hand over the pile of books.
"This use of tools and constructs, there is so much more you could accomplish with your talents. So much more to explore."
"There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy," Celia quotes at him.
"Please, no Shakespeare."
"I am haunted by the ghost of my father. I think that should allow me to quote Hamlet as much as I please. You used to be quite fond of Shakespeare, Prospero."
"You are too intelligent for this behavior. I expected more of you."
"I apologize for not living up to your absurd expectations, Papa. Don't you have anyone else to bother?"
"There are very few people I can converse with in this state. Alexander is dreadfully boring, as always. Chandrish was interesting enough, but that boy has altered his memory so many times that it's not much better than talking to myself, though it might be nice for a change of scenery."
"You talk to Chandrish?" Celia asks.
"Occasionally,"
Hector says, inspecting the clock as it turns within its cage.
"You told Chandrish that Alexander was going to be at the circus that night. You sent him there." "I made a suggestion to a drunk. Drunks are highly suggestible and nicely accepting of conversations with dead people."
"You must have known he could do nothing to Alexander," Celia says. The reasoning makes no sense. Not that her father's reasoning often does.
"I thought the old man could use a knife in the back for a change. That student of his was practically screaming to do it himself, so much so that the idea of it was already in Chandrish's head. All of that rage sneaking into his subconscious from being exposed to it over time. All I had to do was give him a push in the right direction."
"You said there was a rule about interference," Celia says, placing down her pen.
"Interfering with you or your opponent," her father clarifies. "I can interfere with anyone else as much as I please."
"Your interfering got Friedrich killed."
"There are other clockmakers in the world," Hector says. "You can find a new one if you're in need of additional timepieces."
Celia's hands are shaking as she picks up a volume from the pile of Shakespeare and hurls it at him. As You Like It passes through his chest without pause, hitting the wall of the tent beyond and falling to the ground. The raven caws, ruffling its feathers. The cages around the doves and the clock begin to quiver. The glass over the framed photograph cracks.
"Go away, Papa,"
Celia says through clenched teeth, trying to control herself.
"You cannot keep pushing me away," he says.
Celia turns her attention to the candles on the desk, concentrating on a single dancing flame.
"You think you are making personal connections with these people?" Hector continues. "You think you mean anything to them? They are all going to die eventually. You are letting your emotions trump your power."
"You are a coward," Celia says.
"You are both cowards. You fight by proxy because you are too cowardly to challenge each other directly,
afraid that you will fail and have nothing to blame except yourselves."
"That is not true," Hector protests. "I hate you," Celia says, still staring at the candle flame.
The shadow of her father shudders and vanishes. There is no frost upon the windows of Marco's flat, so he inscribes lines of symbols in the shape of a letter A with ink, pressing his darkened fingers against the panes. The ink drips down over the glass like rain. He sits, staring at the door, twisting the silver ring around his finger in anxious circles, until the knock comes early the next morning. The man in the grey suit does not admonish him for calling. He stands in the hall outside the door with his hands on his cane and waits for Marco to speak. "She thinks one of us has to die in order for the game to end," Marco says. "She is correct." Having the confirmation is worse than Marco had expected. The small glimmer of hope he had held that she might be mistaken is crushed in three simple words. "To win would be worse than losing," he says. "I did inform you that your feelings for Miss Bowen would make the challenge more difficult for you," his instructor replies. "Why would you do this to me?" Marco asks. "Why would you spend all that time training me for such a thing?" The pause before the response is heavy. "I thought it preferable to the life you might have had otherwise, regardless of the consequences." Marco closes and locks the door. The man in the grey suit lifts his hand to knock again, but then lowers it and walks away instead. Charming but deadly. You follow the sound of a flute into a hidden corner, the hypnotic melody beckoning you closer. Seated on the ground, nestled in an alcove on striped silk pillows, are two women. One plays the flute you heard. A burning coil of incense sits between them, along with a large black-lidded basket. A small audience is gathering. The other woman carefully removes the lid from the basket before taking out a flute of her own and adding a counter-melody to the first. Two white cobras coil around each other as they rise from the woven basket in perfect time with the music. For a moment, they seem to be one snake and not two, and then they separate again, moving down along the sides of the basket, gliding onto the ground quite close to your feet. The snakes move back and forth together in motions resembling a strikingly formal dance, elegant and graceful. The music increases in tempo, and now there is something harsher about the way the snakes move. Waltz morphs into battle. They circle each other, and you watch for one or the other to strike. One of them hisses softly, and the other responds in kind. They continue to circle as the music and the incense rise into the starry sky above. You cannot tell which snake strikes first. They are identical after all. As they rear and hiss and jump at each other, you are distracted by the fact that they are both no longer stark white, but a perfect ebony black. Precognition. En route from Boston to New York. October 31, 1902. Most of the train's passengers have settled into their respective cars and compartments to read or sleep or otherwise pass the journey. Corridors that were bustling with people at departure time are now nearly empty as Poppet and Widget make their way from car to car, quiet as cats. Tags hang by each compartment door, marked with handwritten names. They stop at the one that reads C. Bowen, and Widget lifts his hand to knock softly on the frosted glass. "Come in," calls a voice from inside, and Poppet slides the door open.
"Are we interrupting anything?" she asks.
"No," Celia says.
"Do come in."
She closes the symbol-filled book she had been reading and places it on a table. The entire compartment looks like an explosion in a library, piles of books and paper amongst the velvet-covered benches and polished wood tables, the light dancing around the room with the motion of the train bouncing off the crystal chandeliers. Widget slides the door closed behind them and latches it.
"Would you like some tea?" Celia asks.
"No, thank you,"
Poppet says. She looks nervously at Widget, who only nods. Celia watches both of them, Poppet biting her lip and refusing to meet Celia's eyes, while Widget leans against the door.
"Out with it," she says.
We
Poppet starts. We have a problem.
What kind of problem? Celia asks, moving piles of books so they can sit on the violet benches, but the twins both remain where they are.
I think something that was supposed to happen didn't happen, Poppet says.
And what might that be? Celia asks.
Our friend Bailey was supposed to come with us.
Ah, yes. Widget mentioned something about that, Celia says. I take it he did not.
No, Poppet says. We waited for him, but he didn't come. But I don't know if that's because he didn't want to or because we left early.
I see, Celia says. It seems a very big decision to me, deciding whether or not to run away and join the circus. Perhaps he did not have enough time to properly consider it.
But he was supposed to come, Poppet says. I know he was supposed to come.
Did you see something? Celia asks.
Sort of.
How does one sort of see something?
It's not as clear as it was before, Poppet says. I can't see anything as clearly as I used to. It's all bits and pieces that don't make sense. Nothing here has made any sense for a year, and you know it.
I think that is an exaggeration, but I understand how it can seem that way, Celia says.
It is not an exaggeration, Poppet says, raising her voice.
The chandeliers begin to shudder, and Celia closes her eyes, taking a deep breath, and waiting for them to return to a gentle sway before she speaks.
Poppet, there is no one here who is more upset by what happened last year than I am, and I have told you before it is not your fault, and there is nothing that could have been done to prevent it, not by you, not by me, not by anyone else. Do you understand that?
Yes, Poppet says. But what's the use in seeing the future if I can't do anything to stop it?
You cannot stop things, Celia says. You can only be prepared for them to happen.
You could stop them,
Poppet mumbles, looking around at the multitude of books. Celia puts a finger under Poppet's chin and turns her head to look her in the eye.
Only a handful of people on this train have any idea how integral I am to the running of the circus, she says. And as much as you two are amongst them, and you are both extremely clever, you do not comprehend the scope of what goes on here, and you wouldn't particularly like it if you did. Now, tell me what you sort of saw.
Poppet closes her eyes, trying to concentrate.
I don't know, she says. It was bright. Everything was on fire. And Bailey was there.
You're going to have to do better than that, Celia says.
I can't, Poppet says. I haven't seen anything clearly since before.
And that's likely because you don't want to see anything clearly after that, and I can't say I blame you. But if you want me to do something to prevent whatever this is, I am going to need more information. She unclasps the long silver chain that hangs around her neck, checking the time on the pocket watch that hangs from it, before she holds it up in front of Poppet's eyes.
Please, Poppet, Celia says. You don't need the stars for this. Just focus, even if you don't want to.
Poppet frowns, then turns her attention to the dangling silver watch as it sways in the warm light. Her eyes narrow, focusing on the reflections in the curve of the watch, and then they soften, looking at something beyond the watch, beyond the train. She starts to sway as her eyes flutter closed, and she falls backward. Widget leaps forward to catch her before she hits the floor. Celia helps him move Poppet to one of the velvet benches by the table, while on a nearby shelf, a cup of tea pours itself, steaming and brewing instantly in a flowered china cup. Poppet blinks, looking up at the chandeliers as though seeing them for the first time, before turning back to Celia to accept the cup of tea.
That hurt, Poppet says. I'm sorry, dearest,
Celia says. I think your sight is getting stronger, which makes it even more troublesome for you to be suppressing it. Poppet nods, rubbing her temples.
Tell me everything you saw, Celia says. Everything. I don't care if it doesn't make any sense. Try to describe it.
Poppet looks into her tea before she starts.
There's a fire, she says. It starts with a bonfire, but bigger
and there's nothing containing it. Like the whole courtyard is on fire. There's a loud noise, and this heat, and...
Poppet pauses, closing her eyes as she attempts to concentrate on the images in her head. She opens her eyes and looks back at Celia.
You're there. You're with someone else, and I think it's raining. And then you're not there anymore, but you still are. I can't explain it. And then Bailey is there. Not during the fire, but after it, I think.
What did the someone else look like? Celia asks.
A man. He was tall, in a suit, with a bowler hat, I think. It was hard to tell.
Celia rests her head in her hands for a moment before she speaks. If that is who I think it is, I know for a fact he is in London at the moment, so perhaps this is not as immediate as you think.
But it is. I'm sure of it.
Poppet protests. Timing has never been your strong point. You said yourself that this friend of yours is also present for this incident, and your first complaint was that he is not here. This might not happen for weeks or months or years, pet.
But we have to do something,
Poppet says, slamming her teacup down on the table. The tea stops before it splashes onto an open book as though there is an invisible wall surrounding it.
To be prepared, like you said.
I will do what I can to prevent the circus from going up in smoke. I shall fireproof it as much as possible. Is that enough for now? After a moment, Poppet nods. Good, Celia says. We'll be off the train in a matter of hours. We can discuss this more later. Wait, Widget says. He has been sitting on the back of one of the velvet benches, staying out of the conversation. Now he turns to Celia.
I have a question before you shoo us away.
What is it?
She asks.
You said we don't comprehend the scope of what goes on here,
he says. That was likely not the best choice of words.
It's a game, isn't it?
Widget asks. Celia looks at him, a slow, sad smile tugging at her lips. It took you 16 years to figure that one out, she says. I expected more from you, Widge.
I guessed as much for a while, he says. It's not easy to see things you don't want me to know, but I've been picking up bits of it lately. You haven't been as guarded as usual.
A game?
Poppet asks, looking back and forth between her brother and Celia.
Like a chess game,
Widget says.
The circus is the board.
Not exactly,
Celia says. It's not as straightforward as chess.
We're all playing a game?
Poppet asks.
Not us, Widget says. Her and someone else. The rest of us are, what, extra pieces?
It's not like that,
Celia says.
Then what is it like?
Widget asks. In response, Celia only looks at him, staring directly into his eyes without wavering. Widget returns her gaze silently for some time while Poppet watches them curiously. Eventually, Widget blinks, the surprise evident on his face. Then he looks down at his shoes. Celia sighs, and when she speaks, she addresses them both.
If I have not been completely honest with you, it is only because I know a great deal of things that you do not want to know. I'm going to ask that you trust me when I tell you I am trying to make things better. It is an extremely delicate balance, and there are a great many factors involved. The best we can do right now is to take everything as it comes and not worry ourselves over things that have happened or things that are to come.
Agreed?
Widget nods, and Poppet reluctantly follows suit.
Thank you, Celia says. Now, please, go and try to get some rest.
Poppet gives her an embrace before slipping out the door back into the hall. Widget lingers a moment.
I'm sorry, he says.
You have nothing to be sorry about, Celia tells him.
I'm sorry anyway.
He kisses her on the cheek before he leaves, not waiting for her to reply.
What was that about?
Poppet asks when Widget joins her in the hall.
She let me read her,
Widget says.
All of her, without concealing anything. She's never done that before.
He refuses to elaborate as they walk quietly back down the length of the train.
What do you think we should do?
Poppet asks once they have reached their car, a marmalade cat crawling onto her lap.
I think we should wait, Widget says. I think that's all we can do right now.
Alone in her book-filled chamber, Celia begins tearing her handkerchief into strips. One at a time, she drops each scrap of silk and lace into an empty teacup and lights it on fire. She repeats this process over and over, working until the cloth burns without charring, remaining bright and white within the flame. Pursuit. En route from Boston to New York, November 1, 1902. It is a cold morning, and Bailey's faded grey coat does not look particularly elegant paired with his new charcoal suit. And he is not entirely certain the two shades are complementary, but the streets and the train station are too busy for him to worry much about his appearance. There are other revers headed to New York, but they end up getting tickets for a later train, so there is a round of farewells and the confusion of sorting dozens of bags before they manage to board. The journey is slow, and Bailey sits staring out the window at the changing landscape, absently gnawing at his fingernails. Victor comes to sit by him, a red leather-bound book in his hands.
"I thought you might like something to read to pass the time," he says as he gives the book to Bailey.
Bailey opens the cover and glances through the book, which he is surprised to see is a meticulously organized scrapbook. Most of the black pages are filled with articles clipped from newspapers, but there are also handwritten letters, the dates ranging from only a few years previous to more than a decade ago.
"Not all of it is in English," Victor explains, "but you should be able to read most of the articles, at least."
"Thank you," Bailey says.
Victor nods and returns to his seat across the car. As the train chugs on, Bailey forgets the landscape entirely. He reads and rereads the words of Herr Friedrich Thiessen, finding them both familiar and entrancing.
"I have never seen you take such a sudden interest in a new river,"
he overhears Lorena remark to her brother,
"especially not to the point of sharing your books."
"He reminds me of Friedrich,"
is Victor's only reply. They are almost to New York when Elizabeth takes the empty seat opposite him. Bailey notes his place in the middle of an article that is comparing the interplay of light and shadow in a particular tent to Indonesian puppet theater before putting the book down.
"We lead strange lives, chasing our dreams around from place to place,"
Elizabeth says quietly, looking out the window.
"I have never met so young a river who clearly feels as strongly toward the circus as those of us who have been following it for years. I want you to have this."
She hands him a red wool scarf, the one she has been knitting on and off. It is longer than Bailey expected from watching her knit, with intricate patterns of knotted cables at each end.
"I can't accept this," he says,
part of him deeply honored, and the other part wishing people would stop giving him things.
"Nonsense," Elizabeth says. "I make them all the time. I am at no loss for yarn. I started this one with no particular revere in mind to wear it, so clearly it's meant for you."
"Thank you," Bailey says, wrapping the scarf around his neck despite the warmth of the train.
"You are quite welcome,"
Elizabeth says.
"We should be arriving soon enough, and then it will only be a matter of waiting for the sun to set."
She leaves him in his seat by the window. Bailey stares out at the grey sky with a mixture of comfort and excitement and nervousness that he cannot reconcile. When they arrive in New York, Bailey is immediately struck by how strange everything looks. Though it is not that different from Boston, Boston had some passing familiarity. Now, without the comforting lull of the train, it strikes him how very far he is from home. Victor and Lorena seem equally discombobulated, but Elizabeth is on familiar ground. She ushers them through intersections and herds them onto streetcars until Bailey begins to feel like one of his sheep. But it does not take long for them to reach their destination, a spot outside the city proper where they are to meet up with another local reveur named August, the same whose room Bailey had inherited in Boston, who has graciously invited them to stay with him at his home until they can find rooms elsewhere. August turns out to be a pleasant, heavy-set fellow, and Bailey's first impression is that he resembles his house, a squat sort of building with a porch wrapping around the front, warm and welcoming. He practically lifts Elizabeth off the ground in greeting and shakes hands so enthusiastically while being introduced to Bailey that his fingers are sore afterward.
"I have good news and bad news," August says as he helps them lift their bags onto the porch. "Which should come first?"
"The good," Elizabeth answers before Bailey has time to consider which would be preferable. "We have traveled too long to be met with bad news straight off."
"The good news," August says, "is that I was indeed correct in predicting the exact location and the circus set up less than a mile away. You can see the tent from the end of the porch if you lean properly."
He points down the left side of the porch from where he stands on the stairs. Bailey rushes to the end of the porch with Lorena close on his heels. The tops of the striped tents are visible through the trees some distance away, a bright punch of white against grey sky and brown trees.
"Wonderful,"
Elizabeth says, laughing at Lorena and Bailey as they lean over the railing. "And what is the bad news, then?"
"I'm not certain it is bad news, precisely,"
August says, as though he is not sure how to explain.
"Perhaps more disappointing, really, regarding the circus."
Bailey steps down from the railing and turns back to the conversation, all the elation he had felt moments before draining away.
"Disappointing?" Victor asks. "Well, the weather is not ideal, as I'm certain you've noticed,"
August says, gesturing up at the heavy grey clouds.
"We had quite a storm last night. The circus was closed, of course, which was odd to begin with, as in all my time I have never seen it set up only to be closed the first night for inclement weather. Regardless, there was some sort of, I don't even know what to call it, a noise of some sort around midnight, a crashing sound that practically shook the house. I thought perhaps something had been struck by lightning. There was a great deal of smoke over the circus, and one of the neighbors swears he saw a flash of light, bright as day. I took a walk down there this morning, and nothing appears to be amiss, though the closure sign is still up on the gates."
"How strange," Lorena remarks.
Without a word, Bailey leaps over the porch railing and takes off in a full run through the trees. He heads toward the striped tents as fast as he can, his red scarf trailing out behind him. Old Ghosts. London, October 31, 1902. It is late, and the pavement is dark despite the street lamps dotting the line of grey stone buildings. Isabel stands near the shadowed stairs of the one she called home for almost a year, what now seems like a lifetime ago. She waits outside for Marco to return, a pale blue shawl pulled around her shoulders like a patch of day-bright sky in the night. Hours pass before Marco appears at the corner. His grip on his briefcase tightens when he sees her.
"What are you doing here?" he asks. "You're supposed to be in the States."
"I left the circus," Isabel said. "I walked away. Celia said I could."
She takes a faded scrap of paper from her pocket, bearing her name, her real name, that he coaxed from her years ago and asked her to write in one of his notebooks.
"Of course she did," Marco says.
"May I come upstairs?"
she asks, fidgeting with the edge of her shawl.
"No,"
Marco says, glancing up at the windows. A dim, flickering light illuminates the glass.
"Please, just say whatever it is you're here to say."
Isabel frowns. She looks around the street, but it is dark and empty, only a crisp breeze blowing through, rustling the leaves in the gutter.
"I wanted to say that I was sorry," she says quietly, "for not telling you that I was tempering. I know what happened last year was partly my fault."
"You should apologize to Celia, not to me."
"I already have," Isabel says. "I knew she was in love with someone, but I thought it was Herr Thiessen. I didn't realize until that night that it was you. But she loved him as well, and she lost him, and I was the cause."
"It was not your fault," Marco says. "There were a great many factors involved."
"There have always been a great many factors involved,"
Isabel says. I didn't mean to get so tangled up in this. I only wanted to be helpful. I wanted to get through this and go back to the way things were before.
We cannot go backward, Marco says. A great deal is not how it used to be.
I know, Isabel says. I cannot hate her. I have tried. I cannot even dislike her. She let me carry on for years, clearly suspicious of her. But she was always kind to me, and I loved the circus. I felt like I finally had a home, a place I could belong.
After a while, I didn't feel like I needed to protect you from her. I felt I should protect everyone else from both of you and both of you from each other.
I started after you came to see me in Paris when you were so upset about the wishing tree. But I knew I had to continue after I read Celia's cards.
When was this? Marco asks.
That night in Prague when you were supposed to meet me, Isabel says. You never let me read for you, not even a single card before last year. I had not realized that before.
I wonder if I would have let this go on so long if I'd had the opportunity.
It took ages for me to truly understand what her cards were saying. I could not see what was right in front of me. I wasted so much time. This was always about the two of you, even before you met. I was only a diversion.
You were not a diversion, Marco says.
Did you ever love me?
Isabel asks. No, Marco admits. I thought perhaps I could, but... Isabel nods.
I thought you did, she says. I was so certain that you did, even though you never said it. I couldn't tell the difference between what was real and what I wanted to be real. I thought this was going to be temporary, even when it kept dragging on and on. But it's not. It never was. I was the one who was temporary. I used to think that if she were gone, you would come back to me.
If she were gone, I would be nothing, Marco says. You should think better of yourself than to settle for that. They stand in silence on the empty street, the chill of the night air falling between them. Good night, Miss Martin, Marco says, starting up the stairs.
The most difficult thing to read is time, Isabel says, and Marco stops, turning back to her. Maybe because it changes so many things. I have read for countless people on innumerable subjects, and the most difficult thing to understand within the cards is always the timing. I knew that, and still it surprised me. How long I was willing to wait for something that was only a possibility. I always thought it was just a matter of time, but I was wrong.
I did not expect this to go on as long as Marco begins, but Isabel interrupts him.
It was all a matter of timing, she says. My train was late that day, the day I saw you drop your notebook. Had it been on schedule, we never would have met. Maybe we were never meant to. It was a possibility, one of thousands, and not inevitable the way some things are.
Isabel, I am sorry, Marco says. I am sorry that I involved you in all of this. I am sorry that I did not tell you sooner how I feel for Celia. I do not know what else you want from me that I can give you.
Isabel nods, pulling her shawl tighter around her shoulders. I read for someone a week ago, she says. He was young, younger than I was when I met you, tall in the way of someone who is not yet used to being tall. He was genuine and sweet. He even asked me my name, and everything was in his cards, everything. It was like reading for the circus, and that has only happened to me once before when I read for Celia.
Why are you telling me this? Marco asks.
Because I thought he could have saved you. I didn't know how to feel about that. I still don't. It was there, in his cards, along with everything else, as plain as anything I have ever seen. I thought then that this was going to end differently. I was wrong. I seem to be wrong quite frequently. Perhaps it is time for me to find a new occupation.
Marco stops, his face going pale in the lamplight. What are you saying? He asks.
I am saying that you had a chance, Isabel says, a chance to be with her, a chance for everything to resolve itself in a favorable manner. I almost wanted that for you, truly, in spite of everything. I still want you to be happy, and the possibility was there.
She gives him a small, sad smile
as she slides her hand into her pocket. But the timing isn't right.
She removes her hand from her pocket and uncurls her fingers. In her palm sits a pile of sparkling black crystals, silt as fine as ash.
What is that?
Marco asks as she lifts her palm to her lips. In response, Isabel blows softly, and the ash flies at Marco in a stinging black cloud. When the dust clears, Marco's briefcase sits abandoned on the pavement by her feet. Isabel takes it with her as she leaves. Aftermath. New York, November 1, 1902. Though the surroundings have changed, the circus looks exactly the same as it did in his own fields, Bailey thinks when he finally reaches the fence, holding a stitch in his side and breathing heavily from running through an area that is more woods than fields. But something more than that is different. It takes him a moment of trying to catch his breath by the side of the gates, staring at the sign that reads, "Closed due to inclement weather," hanging over the normal sign denoting the hours of operation. It is the smell, he realizes. It is not the smell of caramel blended perfectly with the woody smoke of a warming fire. Instead, it is the heavy scent of something burned and wet, with a sickly sweet undertone. It makes him nauseous. There is no sound within the bounds of the curling iron fence. The tents are perfectly still. Only the clock beyond the gates makes any motion, slowly ticking by the afternoon hours. Bailey discovers quickly that he is not able to slip through the bars of the fence as easily as he did when he was 10. The space is too narrow, no matter how he tries to shift his shoulders. He half expected Poppet to be there waiting for him, but there is not a soul in sight. The fence is too high to climb, and Bailey is considering simply sitting in front of the gates until sundown when he spots a curving tree branch that does not quite reach the fence but comes close, hanging above the twisting iron spikes at the top. From there, he could jump. If he got the angle right, he would land in a path between tents. If he got the angle wrong, he'd likely break his leg. But that would be only a minor problem that could be dealt with, and then at least he would be inside the circus. The tree is easy enough to climb, and the limb closest to the circus wide enough to manage until he gets closer to the fence. But he is unable to balance well, and while he attempts a graceful leap, it ends up being something closer to a planned fall. He lands heavily in the path, rolling into the side of the tent and taking a large amount of the white powder on the ground with him. His legs hurt, but seem to be in working order, though his shoulder feels badly bruised, and the palms of his hands are a mess of scrapes and dirt and powder. The powder brushes off his hands easily enough, but sticks like paint to his coat and the legs of his new suit. And now he stands alone inside the circus again. "Truth or dare?" he mutters to himself. Dry, fragile leaves dance around his feet, drawn in through the fence by the wind, spots of muted autumn color disrupting the black and white. Bailey is not certain where to go. He wanders through paths, expecting to see Poppet around every corner, but he is met only with stripes and emptiness. Finally, he heads toward the courtyard, toward the bonfire. As he turns a corner that opens up into the wide space of the bonfire courtyard, he is more surprised by the fact that the fire is not burning than he is to find that there is indeed someone waiting for him. But the figure standing by the cauldron of curling iron is not Poppet. This woman is too short, her hair too dark. When she turns, she has a long silver cigarette holder at her lips, and the smoke curls around her head like snakes. It takes him a moment to recognize the contortionist, having only ever seen her upon a platform bending herself into impossible shapes. "You are Bailey, yes?" she says. "Yes," Bailey answers, wondering if absolutely everyone in the circus knows who he is. "You are late," the contortionist tells him. "Late for what?" Bailey asks, confused. "I doubt she will be able to hold on much longer." "Who?" Bailey asks, though the thought pops into his head that the contortionist might be referring to the circus itself.
And, of course, she continues, had you arrived earlier, it might have played out differently.